This is a Pinball News production.
Thank you. Well, there's a couple seats up here. You guys don't have to stand. It's not a standing room only. One, two, three, four. There's a couple in there. Yeah, there's a couple up here. Just take, anybody want to sit up here with me, that's fine too. Yeah. There's a couple more chairs.
By the way, Gary's asked me to do something special here. This is the old fireside chat concept where you sit the floor around.
Now that's what we call improvisation. Improvisation? Some such thing.
Did that work?
Oh, it did work. I like that picture. Okay. All right. Thank you all. Yes, the reason that this is so late, I appreciate you all coming in because there's so much, many other things going on at this fine show that we've been at for years and years. It is late, and Rob was nice enough to redo the schedule to let me chat with people, not knowing what I was going to say or do. He didn't. I had some idea. It was not actually a red eye that I came in on. I was in lucky enough to handle our export sales. And I say lucky enough because I was just at a trade show in Rome where I was going to spend the weekend, but didn't because I'm here. Italy is our one of our largest export markets. We export half of our games. You know, we all talk about, I'll do this quick, but how many of you have heard me do this before, talk before? Well, I'm going to do part of it the same, part of it different, because I want to. You've heard, then those of you who have heard me talk, I'll do this quickly, know that I talk about three legs to our stool. We segment the market. We look at different segments of that market that that are important, and that includes operators. You say, operators, aren't any games out there. We'll come back to that. That includes enthusiasts, collectors like yourselves, very important to us. And that includes just general homeowners. I tongue-in-cheek say rich doctor lawyers, but it's really many, many middle-class people who have games at home, have one game. They're not quite like you all. They got one game, and they're a little bit different. They have to, you know, they're mostly male. They had games when they were played pinball when they were in college. Some such thing, or when they were young men, and they have to tell mommy that the game's for the kids, and then they get a game in their home, and it's a game, but it's also a piece of art, a piece of Americana, a piece of furniture. It's something special for them to have. You know, all large ticket items that go in the home are ultimately bought by mommy, not by daddy. Daddy may want them. Now you're a little different because you guys are collectors, and maybe you got a handle over the wives, maybe you don't, but I had a friend, a customer who's a billiard store owner, and she says a guy comes in, she'll talk to him for 45 minutes, you know, whatever he wants, looking at pool tables or pinball machines or whatever. If he comes in with his wife, she'll close the sale. She won't if she's not there. And yeah, you want that 52-inch TV? Probably going to have to ask somebody if that's okay to do it. So any event, I'm digressing because I said that you guys may not appreciate how important. There's a couple chairs up here. Operators are to our business, and they are extremely important to us. I just came from Italy, which is one of our largest export markets. We export something over half of our pinball machines. Most of those are to operators. There is a large operating community of pinball, a little bit less than America, probably 70% of our games in America, and that's half of our business. 70% of our games are sold to homeowners, being either you all or those, what I call the rich doctor lawyers, who may not be quite that rich, but they may not even be doctor lawyers. But the operating community is very important to us. And it's very important to you all also. This is where I usually end, so I'm starting at the back. It's very important to you all also, and that's because you're pinball collectors, pinball enthusiasts. And pinball machines are cool. They're cool because your kids think they're cool. My kids, 25 and 31, think they're cool. They're cool because there's something current. They're out there. They're getting less current. We need to have them be more current. We need to make games that cost less and make more money, not cost more and play longer. We need games that play the right time. This is where you're supposed to speak up and say yes, because you always do that for me. That's it, see? less in play for the right amount of time because he's selling time and entertainment. And when you have a game that plays forever by the great player who plays for 45 minutes on half a buck and doesn't need to play again, and then I play for 45 seconds or half a buck and don't want to play again, that game that costs more than $4,000 is not going to pay for itself at a buck an hour. It isn't going to happen, especially when the operator's splitting that. Operators are important to us because if we don't have games out there, and you guys as collectors are not going to, you won't, but you're the next generation of y'all will lose interest. I do the McMansion story comparison, and you know, you drive by one of these McMansions and there's four garage doors, and one of them has a Mercedes because it's a big rich guy's house, it's got four garages, it's got a Mercedes, dad's car, the second garage has a Lexus SUV, mommy's car, the third garage has a Jeep Wrangler, that's the kid's car, and the fourth garage has a horse and buggy because dad collects horses and buggies. No, he doesn't. It's got an old bathtub Porsche or something like that because he collects cars, because he collects something that is current. And if it wasn't current, if we didn't have any more cars, over a period of time, he'd lose interest in collecting them. The same thing is true of pinball. If pinball is not a real part of American society, part of society, part of entertainment, then it's not going to be of interest to you all anymore. But I wasn't going to do that until later, because really what I'd like to do is tell you a couple stories of how we got here, what we do, and so forth. It's a knocker on a pinball machine. It just knocks, when somebody got a free play. It's an old-time knocker, okay? For those of you who remember old-time knockers. You know why the knocker was on a pinball machine? You all should know this. Yeah, that's a good answer, but that's not why it was there. For an operator, the knocker was a spare coil. When he went to that bar on Saturday night and the game was broken, he had a spare coil, the knocker. He took that coil out and he ran the game. You know why there's a magnet in the bottom of the game? Screws. Who said that? When you're working on a game and you take something apart, you got to put the screws somewhere. That's why the speaker's in the bottom of the game. Okay, you don't have to believe everything I say. George is laughing at me right now. I'm tired. I'm just sort of wandering around here. So in any event, we're going to talk a little bit about how we got here. And that's an old game that we never made. Not bad, though. I rather like it. It's a nice concept. It's sort of like, do they have Hercules here this year? Yeah, it's the same type of concept, a showpiece, that type of thing. But that would be from the late 40s, probably. I don't know exactly. Yeah, absolutely. But that's actually not in a showroom. That's in the lobby of one of the factories, the entranceway. Looking at the floor finish and the wall finish, and that's the way offices looked in those days. There we go. Of course, the historians know what it is. And what year was that, Gary? Yeah. Pardon? Okay. Then all we got to do is Google when that was, which one of you guys with your computers could do. And by the time I get talking, please let us know, when that was. Somebody get their little phone out and so forth. I'm 67. I've been in this making pinball machines for 65 years. So it gives me a chance to right now. Guys my age who have been in a business, we tend to start talking about the past once in a while, that type of thing. And so I enjoy it, so I'll do a little bit of that. My father isn't him. That's Harry Williams. That's my father. That's my father, Sam Stern. And my father started as a game operator in the 30s. And in fact, graduated high school and he had a couple friends that were cops and said, you should get a couple of these games, these pinball machines. And pinball machines, as you know, were pinball machines. They had pins and a little countertop, and you put them on the counter. So he got himself two of those games, and he put them in a drugstore, and he came back the next day, and they were behind the counter. And two other games are up there, somebody else's games. And he said to his two friends who are cops, what did you get me into? Why am I there? He said, oh, not that location. That belongs to these guys. You need to go to this location. So Sam takes his two games, which you could carry yourself, puts them in the other location, puts them on the counter, everything's fine. 10 o'clock that night, he gets a call, his games are broken. One of his games is broken. Now that's it. He's done with this business. He says, I don't want anything more to do with it. This is nothing but trouble. And he runs down to his location to fix whatever it was, because he had to do that. And the problem was, if you remember, old games had push chutes. You know, you put the coins in, you push it, like a laundromat machine today. You push it in, and it had so many coins in it that the push chute wouldn't push in anymore. It was jammed. So all of a sudden, he thought this was a good business, and so he became a game operator in seriousness. I used to take my mom out on dates, stopping at a spot and collect the jukebox, and that's how he paid for that. You know, he came from, my grandparents were immigrants, and so it wasn't like they had a lot of money to invest in this. And this was just a new thing that he got into. He got into a small entrepreneurial business. In that time, we have game distributors, commercial game distributors of two types in the country today, in this country. We have people who were operator distributors. My father became an operator distributor. He was an operator who needed games sooner and for less money, beat his competition, so he became a distributor. He was an operator that became a distributor. In the 70s, in the 70s and 80s, we ended up with a lot of distributor operators, and those were distributors who had put out so much money financing operators for video games, and industry, you know, cyclical, and it went down, so they ended up taking over the routes, and they became distributors who were operators. And in my father's day, the distributors who were distributors did better than the operators. In this latter day, the operators, the distributors who became operators did better as operators. And some of them were very, very successful with the operation. That's why you saw some big consolidated operations happen in those times. Any event, so Sam became a distributor, and he was a distributor in Philadelphia. And in 1947, he was a 35-year-old punk kid. I can say that. He was born in 1912, but I can say he was a 35-year-old punk kid because I'm 67, so I can call a 35-year-old punk even though I'm talking about my father. So he comes in to see his supplier, Harry Williams. That was Harry in an earlier coin machine magazine in the 30s. And I think, I hope you all know who Harry Williams was. But the great pinball game designer who coined, you know, who would talk to me about, it's like the second father, about the ball being wild, and that was the key to pinball. It's a ball and bat game, really. It's a game that's not simulated. It's a game that you don't know. The randomness is going to be supplied by that ball. So, thank you, George. I just took your line. But any event, so he comes in to see Harry. And, let's talk. Harry was, as I said, Harry was a great game designer, and he had the Williams Company at the time. But Harry had started as an operator in the West Coast and then became a game designer. He had a company, Advance, in L.A. He came up with a very, very successful game called Contact. It had electricity, which was probably where the word contact comes from. It was very, you know, it was revolutionary and ended up being made by Bally and Ray Maloney. Maloney had a number of great designers working for him, or important people to our industry. Harry became close friends with a guy named Lynn Durant, and Durant is the gentleman that invented the puckballer. Harry and Lynn left Bally. Harry and Lynn started their own company, and for a while had it until Harry separated. So Williams kept Harry Durant kept United. Harry kept started Williams, and at United, Durant designed the puck bowler, the Shuffle Alley. In 1949, he was making 525 of these puck bowlers a day. He was selling them for $225, $1949. They were costing him $125, so he was making $100 a piece times 525 games a day in 1949, which was a lot of money then, and it'd be a lot of money today, $50-some thousand a day, $250,000 a week, $1 million a month, and he died broke. So it is the game business. Well, he used to do stuff, you know. Williams ultimately moved into the Durant factory, the United factory, in that factory. So I saw it. He had, you know, an apartment upstairs. You know, he would go. He was a partier, and he would. They were all a little wilder in those days. He would go down to Rush Street here in Chicago and give out $100 bills, you know, as tips. Give people Cadillacs, give girls fur coats, stuff like that. He was making, you know, $250,000 a week in 1949. He could afford to do that. He went. He used to go to the Chez Paris, which was the big nightclub here. My mother used to take me there when I was little bitty, and I slept under the table when she went to see Tony Bennett. I guess she loved Tony Bennett, and I slept well through him. Any event, he. Durant, I was doing a deal once with Jack Schatz. Jack Schatz was the, boy, I must be getting old. I'm telling stories like this. Jack Schatz was the head of the Chez Paris in those days, and I'm doing a deal with him later, and he said, he's in the elevator once with Durant. The elevator's on the second floor. I mean, the elevator goes to the second floor. The Chez Paris, which was, you know, a 40s, 50s nightclub, was on the second floor. So they get halfway up from the first floor to the second floor, and Lynn Durant says, to the elevator operator. There's no buttons. There's a guy, you know, with a handle and the, you know, up, down. He says, stop the elevator. I want a drink. Schatz says, what are you crazy? Where are you going to get a drink? The elevator door is open, and in the brick elevator shaft, there was a little alcove, and Durant had built a bar in there. He bought the booze, full price, up at the Chez. He had a bar in there so that he could stop the elevator and serve drinks to his guests on the way up to it. And these guys were, you know, it was a different world. Any event. One time, we had a bomb threat at Williams when I was there. My father owned Williams, and I was working for him, and my business card read something like boss's son, and people understood that what my authority was. And so we had a bomb threat. We had two bomb threats. The first one we get, and my father was at the airport. He calls back, and I said, Dad, we got a bomb threat. And he said, what do you want I should do? Click, so I had to figure out what to do. And basically, we made a determination to take the risk, and nobody got blown up. It was a height threat. Bally was across the street, and every week you see all the employees out in the street waiting for them to clear the bomb because they listened to the bomb threats. We didn't. Therefore, our people were inside. Luckily, they were all phony. We got another bomb threat, and so my car wasn't running, so I had to take a cab. It was for the next day. It wasn't going to blow us up until the next day. I go home. I'm going to meet all the foremen back, and we're going to search the whole place in the morning. So I take a cab, and I tell them 3401 North California, which is the Williams address. And he says, oh, that's Williams. That's United Manufacturing. The reason he knew that is there was a famous story among the cabbies that one Christmas Eve, Durant called for a cab at 3401 North California. He lived upstairs. Cabbie took him downtown to Rush Street. Why are you working tonight? I need presents for my family. I don't have any money. So he gave him a folded up dollar bill. Of course, you know, it was a tip. Of course, when the guy unfolded it, it was a $100 bill. That was Durant. So there was always cabs waiting for years at Riverview, he's looking at what's that, Clybourne and Belmont. There's a cab stand, there's a cab place there, and there's a line of cabs always waiting for Durant for years and years. Anyhow, back to being 67 and digress. So my father, as I told you, came in to see Harry, his supplier, his manufacturer, and he, you know, kidding around, 35-year-old punk kid, puts his feet up on the desk. Harry, do I got Harry? I got Harry. Puts his feet up on the desk, and sitting behind Harry's desk in Harry's chair, puts his feet up on the desk and says, why don't you sell me the company? And Harry said, I'll have to think about that. I'll go up. He went up. Yeah, there he is. Harry goes up in his airplane to fly around Chicago for 3 hours thinking about it, came down and sold Sam half of Williams. So from 1947, when I was two, I've been in and around the pinball business. At that time, they were on Huron Street downtown. They had a factory, which when they finally let my father into it, originally they wouldn't even let him in the factory. When they finally let my father into it, he was able to realize what they had. They had a multi-story building. The first story, remember, this is a fledgling business. It's just a beginning business. Right? It's not like today where we've got, you know, 100 people out in the factory. How many of you toured the factory while you were here? Good, I don't feel so bad about not running the disc showing the factory because you've all seen it. Many of you have. So they had, you know, they didn't have 100 and some people, you know, like we do out there building games. You know, it was still very labor intensive, but the games were much simpler. In fact, Harry used to say that he could come up with a game design idea. He could build one. He could sample it. He could figure out the wiring and use relays and step-up units and put it together, figure out the rules, figure out what it could do. He could do the whole thing and build the whole prototype himself. The whole business, the whole world got much more complicated. Now you need graduate designers like George. You need mechanical engineers. You need software programmers who also should know pinball. You need all kinds of people and computer control assisted design, 3D tools, everything to build a game. It wasn't quite that complicated. The factory they were in was multi-story. The first floor was jacks, just jacks, you know, holding up the second floor so that they could manufacture on the second floor. On the third floor, they had jacks holding up the fourth floor so they could manufacture on the fourth floor. And on the fifth floor, they had jacks holding up the sixth floor. So they had three floors of manufacturing and three floors of jacks. Ultimately, you're like, this is true. Ultimately, they moved to 4242 West Fillmore, which is not too far from the Churchill Cabinet Company today in Cicero. And occasionally I drive by it and look at it. It was a rough neighborhood then. It was down the street from the Fillmore Police Station where the neighbors used to steal the batteries out of the cop cars. There was a big jewel robbery downtown. The getaway car came off of our parking lot. Any event, I hope you're enjoying this because I'm having a hell of a time. This is fun for me. But I drive by it every couple of years now because I'm going to Churchill just to remind myself. And it's really quite a blighted neighborhood. And if I do this again, I'm going to add a picture of it. It's a mess. I'll do it before and after. It's just pathetic. And most of the area is vacant. Anyway, so they were in that factory for many years. And that's where I started hanging around pinball. I did wonderful things like go down on Saturdays and take all the different switchblades and mix them up, because I didn't understand the difference of it. I don't know how many of you are really familiar with the old stack leaf switches that we had. I mean, I go way back in this stuff, so I know it all. When I was a kid, I had my desk at home. Instead of doing homework, I had my pop bumpers and posts, and I made my little pinball machine layouts in the desk drawer. And better than that, I had the little cardboard men on the little metal stick that from the men running unit in the baseball games. Every year, Williams made a baseball game. They made one that was great. Gordon Horlick messed that up. But it was a great concept. It had these three red cups. Now, let me back up. Harry was famous for, in the late 30s, designing the most intricate you guys, if you haven't seen one of these, a Rocola baseball. It is fantastic. You ever see one, George? This is a mechanical marvel. It was absolutely fantastic, and throwing the ball and this or that. Well, they took this baseball game, and Gordon Horlick was his chief engineer. Gordon Horlick's real fame was, real, not fame, real talent, it wasn't that he was a good mechanical engineer. Remember Harry in the plane? Gordon trained bomber pilots in World War II. So he was a natural for Harry. And so they had at Williams on Fillmore, they had a Link trainer. Anybody know what a Link trainer is? It's this root box that you sit in and fly by instrument on the ground to train yourself in instruments. So all afternoon, Harry and Gordon, again, business wasn't quite as serious then as it is today. You know, our pinball business is very serious. It was not quite as serious. Harry and Gordon would spend the afternoon flying the Link trainer. Sam, my father, flew it once, made a perfect landing, except he was 300 feet underground. Other than that, it was fine. So any event, Gordon designs this baseball game, and it had three red cups with little ramp into the cup, and the ball would go in, and then the cup would turn, and the solenoid would kick it out, and it go throw the ball, you know, from the shortstop to the first baseman or things like that. You know, it's a double play type game. It was great, except it didn't work. Other than that, it was fantastic. It's not unusual in the game business to design something and find out after you build some that it doesn't work. In fact, our first two pinball machines at Date East Pinball had one thing in common. It didn't work. Other than that, they were great, you know. It's real hard to get this right the first time you do something. So they built like 300 of these, which wouldn't be so bad because they had to take them back, and they got like 400 back, which is a normal thing also that happens. Somehow the returns multiply, you know, especially happens in video games. You know, you build 300 of a video game, they go out, and you get things back that they say was that video game, and you say, no, that's a board from something else. No, it is. But you end up getting more back than you sent out when it doesn't work. It's, you know, there's a risk involved in that. The nature of the operator in those days figured out how to send more back. Harry, let's go back to Williams for a minute, and I'm way out of order, but I'm going to do it anyways. What Williams was doing when he left Durant and started Williams is you couldn't buy parts to make games, and he was making games. This was World War II, 1942. So what was he going to do? He figured out that if you had such and such a game, Mr. Operator, you send them here, I will take them apart, I will use the copper, the coils, you know, the metal parts, and I will make that into a new game, you know, of such and such model. And that's what he did. He did game conversions before he started making pinball machines. I actually tried game conversions myself. When we left Stern, the first Stern, with Steve Kirk, I made Gamatron, which was Harry's wide body, Flight 2000, back to a narrow body, which in some degree played better. Wide bodies, Harry explained, are difficult to design because there's so much more space. You either had to put so much stuff in them that they, you know, they're not game anymore. There's too much going on for most people to get. You guys have figured it out, but for most people. Or they play very slow. You got this much more geometry. So the ball going from right to left and left to right. Well, I think that Gamatron played better than Flight 2000. Unfortunately, we proved that the conversion concept didn't work. That's because Steve Kirk had Steve Kirk was designing it with me. Steve Ritchie at that time came out with High Speed. And why would you take an old Bally game, which we were converting, and put the money into putting in something new into it when you could trade it in, get something for it, and get a new High Speed? So the economics just don't work. And if you think about the games you have value, why would you ever convert one of those games? You will sell it to another collector and buy a new game, you wouldn't convert it to a different game. So from the economics of game operators, I proved the flaw in it. Go back to a couple pictures here. That was Harry's boat. As I said, he was a very successful young man in California, so he had this boat made for him. I picked out a bunch of old pictures, so now we're not going to do much with them. Harry and Kitchy, that's his daughter in the car with him. Is that the right picture? I believe that's his daughter, as best as I can remember. Harry was married three times. His last wife, Wanda, did outlive him. His first two wives, Lee and it'll come to me. His first two wives died on the same day. I don't mean the same date. I mean the same date, same year, same day. Just bizarre thing. But they died on the same day. Wanda live with Harry in Palm Springs. As I said, I was around Harry and Sam this whole time. I started, you know, in the factory just playing with things and so forth. Harry loved making train game designs, and not necessarily pinball, but designs. He would take me to the Museum of Science in Industry, and we'd look at the big train that's down there. You know, I was always around them and listening to them talk and listening to them with the other customers. It was an education just to be around it all. And then everything around us was pinball. or you made it out of something that was pinball. I had a pet rabbit, or my friend and I had a pet rabbit, and the rabbit cage, think of, you take a back box to a game, an old electromechanical game. You take a back box, you put wood, it had a wood back, later a metal back. You put chicken wire over where the back lattice is, you lay it down on its back, and where the wires go through from the neck, that's the door that you shove the rabbit in and out of. That was my rabbit cage. You know, everything was made out of pinball. Any event, in 49, the Williams Company bought Harry Out. They bought Harry Out. This picture's interesting to me, but I'll come to it. They bought Harry Out, so Sam owned it all. Harry always worked with us designing games, except for a short period when he, in 59, he became the distributor in America for a French-made jet, a four-passenger jet. I'm going to butcher this. Moraine Saulnier was the company. So he was the distributor that imported these jets to sell to businessmen. He didn't like it that much because there was no coin slot on it, he said, so he went back to games. So he was always designing stuff with my father and for us. And I learned a great lesson of how to convince people that a particular game feature is good at game design. Harry would come in. Now, I'm working there from the time I'm 16. Sam started me in the summers. Sam started me in the stock room, and everything went very well. This was on Fillmore Street. The only thing that didn't go well was the one day that it was very hot, and boss's son working in the stock room, counting parts, all that. But, starting at the bottom, I put up a sign that said Sammy's Sweatshop, and there was panic, pandemonium in the place, that God forbid my father would see that. Because my father was not a manager like me. My father was a manager. You know, he was old time. You know, he knew what to do and told you what to do. Although the one thing he did do, you're sitting there talking, you're across the desk, and he's behind his big desk, and he's writing notes, and he writes down, your three action items, things to do, and he gives you the piece of paper. Didn't take long for me to figure out that I had the only copy, But he was also the type, though, that would walk by, and you'd be working on some numbers, and as you walk by, he'd turn around and say, that's wrong, you should, he was fantastic. Any event, so Harry would come in from California and stay at a hotel. I'd pick him up from the airport, take him over to Sam's house, and the three of us are on the floor looking at a full-size playfield drawing. You know, today they've got CAD, they've got SolidWorks, three-dimensional computer stuff. In those days, there was big drafting table, paper, and a lot of pencils and erasers. Now, it got better. There were electric erasers, but before that, there weren't even electric erasers. And that's how they drew a playfield. There weren't as many multi-levels as now, but, it was, you wanted to change something, it was erase, and redraw. So here we are, we're on the floor looking at this, and Sam and Harry are looking at it, and Sam says, oh, this looks great, that looks great. This, over here in this corner, I think you should do something different, like this, this, or that, Harry says, oh, that's a good idea. I pick Harry up in the morning from the hotel, which had no drafting table, and he had a drawing with that upper corner, this, 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 and that, already done in it. He obviously had come to Chicago with two drawings. He put something for Sam to criticize so that he wouldn't get on, that he knew was blatantly wrong, so that he wouldn't get into some other area of the game. He'd leave everything else alone. Yeah, I know you do. I know. Thank you, George. I knew that. Okay, so our second game, I guess, was Stingray after pinball. But you had to have mask ROMs then. And it wasn't EPROMs, mask ROMs. You had to order them 16, 18 weeks in advance, maybe more. What? How do you do that when you're designing a game? So here we're done with the first game. We're starting the second. We got no software. I said, not a problem. I got a switch here that does A, and a switch here is 100 points. I'll make a stack switch, and I'll light A and score 100 points. But I got to convince Sam. I was the president of the company. He was working part-time. I got to convince Sam this was a good idea. So I had the guys put a flipper right in the middle of the play field. I almost swore. Right in the middle of the play field. If the slingshots are here, the flipper was here, the targets were here. And it was just sideways, a flipper in the middle of the play field. And so Sam looked at that and said, I mean, that's so stupid, you can't do that, no, you know. So therefore, we were able to do stack switches, which I knew he had originally objected to. Some of this, you know, you do. Don't listen to this, George. Don't be listening to this. Anyhow, you know that our first, that the old Stern electronic system was very similar to a Bally electronic system. It's called reverse engineering sometimes. There's, you know, what was that? Creative copying, yes, that's the other word for reverse engineering. Absolutely. And that, Sam had, see, Maloney died. He was the head of Bally. And Maloney died, and the guy who was the head of sales, a guy named Bill O'Donnell, had started, guess where? In the stock room, because that's a manufacturing company. When Maloney died, what was he going to do? He wanted to put a group together to buy the company, but if he didn't, Sam said, I don't need you. You have a job with me at Williams. Bill never forgot that. So when it came time for us to have a solid-state system, we didn't have time to design one. Bill sent a game from the pinball factory to the factory on Belmont Avenue. I sent a truck to Belmont Avenue, picked it up, brought it over to Diversey, to our factory, and Bill said, if there's a problem, let me know, okay? Luckily, we were able to do it without any help. Billy Jr. wasn't too happy with Bill, his son, for letting us do that, but it actually was a marketing help to them, and we weren't taking that much business away from them. The idea was to keep Williams on their own system and make one system that was good for everybody. You know, these guys were all, I used to go drinking with Sam Stern, Bill O'Donnell, these titans of our pinball industry, and this little 27-year-old punk kid, me. I wasn't even 35 yet. And they would drink me under the table at the pump room, at the old pump room, under the table, except for one time. We started a couple other places. And they'd talk about things like the electronic system, what have you. There was one time I was able to put my father to bed. It was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful. I was going to talk about a lot of different things, but I do want to mention, a couple things. We've been, let's see, what are the pictures I have? Let me blow them out before we finish this up. I got, that's Harry in his plane. Oh, wait. That's Harry, Kitty, one of his wives, his daughter, not Lee, Kitty's his daughter, Lee was his wife. And that's Ruth and Al Stern. No relations. Worldwide Distributing was the Sterns here. That was a big distributor. And Al Stern and Sam Stern used to take their sons to the circus. Their sons also were involved in the business for some time on the distributing side. As I said, I worked in the stockroom. I started in the stockroom, as Bill O'Donnell did. And that's because it's a manufacturing business. I had been around, all these. This is me as a little kid and my father, because I want to embarrass myself. But, you know, while he was in pinball, of course, I was around all the time, one way or another. Working there when I was 16, 17, 18, and home from college, and I'm working there in the summers. And we had a little disagreement, business disagreement, and either I quit or he fired me. Undoubtedly, he fired me. And so 7 in the morning, my mother wakes me up to go to work. My mother, gotta have a picture of Mom. So there's my mother. So my mother wakes me up to go to work. I said, Mom, I don't have to go to work. Sam fired me. And she said, well, I just rehired you. Get your ass out of bed and go to work. And so I was continuing to work there. But with Sam, at Williams, it was, Stern, the first Stern, it was a great thing. I was the president, and really I was operating the company. Sam was 67, my current age. We started the company because my sister-in-law said that he's cleaned my closets twice this week. You got to get him a job. I was a bankruptcy lawyer. You know, my father wanted me to not necessarily go in this business. So my brother's a doctor. I'm a lawyer, and I was a bankruptcy lawyer. We bought Chicago Coin, Chicago Dynamic Industries, its assets out of a bank foreclosure. My father knew the bankers. I didn't. And every morning, yeah, as a young man, I was 30, so whatever. If that, 31, maybe partied a little too much, didn't quite get out of bed real early. well, actually partied too much. My father started as a game operator. I started one step removed, and I'm not going to say up or down. I was the location owner. Myself, Luna Castro, the head of Seaberg, his secretary, and her husband and I bought Wise Fools Pub. So we had a bar over on Lincoln Avenue, not far from your place, to say the least. It was a little different place then. It was a blues and jazz place. Monday nights it had 16-piece studio musicians, all studio musicians. It was their day off, and it just sold us on buying the place, and we did. And by the way, I invested $4,000 for a third of it in those days. That was it. It was a different world. You like that? You like that a lot, huh? Two shares, yeah. Yeah, $4,000 for, yeah. You can't open a bar for $12,000 today. We bought an existing place. But what we do see today, now I'll digress again, Mike has games in his place, both of his places, pinballs. There are new places opening up. The One Up in LA and in Denver now has the Two Up. It's 42 1980s upright videos and 14 pins and three skee balls that get replaced every 8 months, brand new. Here's the Emporium, which is 80s video and five pinball. A new place just opened called, you sent me an email, over in your neighborhood, there's another new one like this with the game. These are places that 20-somethings are going to. Guys, girls, dates, couples, not couples, they're going to. Instead of having a DJ or what have you, there's a resurgence of interest in games. And these places are getting these young people in there, and they're playing these games, and they're playing simple games, games that you know that they can understand and know what to do. I'm going to do one or two more things here, and then take some questions. We started Data East in '86. We work with some great people, a few of whom aren't around anymore. More Neil Falconer was a great programmer, rules design guy. Ed Cibula, of course, was Joe Camico's mechanical engineer. If you come to the dinner tonight, you might well hear him talk about both of those. In 94, we sold the company from Data East. We didn't own it. We ran it. We sold it from Data East to Sega and changed its name to Sega Pinball. And then in 99, Sega, great company, but really didn't need a little pinball company. So we bought it from them. And change its name to Stern Pinball. It's the same business. It's the same company making pinball machines. The difference, as I said earlier, is we've segmented the market. But most important, I want to say that you know there's a lot of people involved in making these games. And it is a manufacturing business. Think of us as a car company, and a car company. They're not a car company. They're a manufacturer that makes cars. They design cars not for the love of cars. They may love cars, you know, but not because they love cars. They need to design the product to build. So they design the best cars possible to be manufacturers. And the real key to it is both in the design for manufacturing, is it designed to be a good car that drives good or drives cool? Is it going to manufacture well, and is it going to be quality car? Manufacturing, American manufacturing. Our company, for 26 years, has designed pinball so that we can manufacture pinball. Yes, we love pinball. We do it because we love it. I do it because I've been doing it for 65 years and my father before me. You know, you look in the world and you find people running for presidents run for president because their father ran for president. People who are presidents become presidents because their father was a president. People who are actors become actors because their fathers or mothers were actors. People who are doctors, kids become doctors, so forth. My father was a pinball manufacturer. I'm a pinball manufacturer. But notice I say pinball manufacturer. We manufacture pinball. We employ people to manufacture in America. We're very patriotic. We do what this country needs, this economy needs, and that's well-designed product, manufactured here, fit for the purpose that it's intended. And that's what these people who work with me work very hard to do. It takes a lot of them, and they do it very well. Now, I had a speech. I just went all over the place, which I'm apt to do. So what I'd like to do, that was 45 minutes of me just reminiscing for my own benefit. Let's see if you guys have any questions. No questions. That was easy. Oh, yes. Pictures of me at the factory as a kid. You know, I doubt it. I've got these two huge briefcases of pictures of Harry's. Yeah. And someday I'm going to organize them. I don't have a lot of pictures. That's Harry and Sam again. I don't have a lot of pictures at Stern, Chicago Coin Stern. I don't have a lot of pictures of me when, you know, my father had every kind of modern camera you could have as a young man. He had a 8 millimeter and then a 16 millimeter movie camera. He had the 3D slide camera. He had, most of you won't remember, the 3D camera. You had a, it was two, instead of one slide, it was two slides. You put it in a little hold-up thing that you push the button, it lit up. He had those. We had all these pictures. When I was 18, my family sold the house with the pictures. That's true. I don't know. It's true. So, no, I doubt it. There's some industry pictures that occasionally come up in the trade magazines, which are typically exceptionally embarrassing. Yeah. Yes?
You mentioned the resurgence in the area of the car arcades. Does Pinball have any machines?
Yes. As I said, there's in the one up, there's 14 pinball machines. All for, but understand, the players in there, the 14 pinball, 42 upright video, 3 skee ball. In Barcade in Brooklyn, there's just video. Emporium has both. And again, Mike's got pinballs and not much video in his places. But understand that the players in those kind of locations are casual players. From my father's and Harry Williams' day, you know, the key was to have a good time for your entertain your not lose your core player, yet broaden your market by having the casual player enjoy the game. And generally, what I've seen happen, whether it be English AWPs, which I can't understand at all how to play. Can you explain those to me? But how they work? I have no idea how they work. Yeah, I know. I never understood that either. Anyhow, but that's exactly what it was supposed to be. So you guys, you understand them. It's like an OK feature bingo, for those of you who know what it is. The players get a little better, so the designers make the game harder. Players get better, make it harder. Players stay home, new crop of players can't play this thing. And that happens in, I don't care if it's, you know, PlayStation or it's English AWPs or, nodding over there. It happens. It's a 7-8 year cycle. Used to be, Joe Keenan used to tell me it was a 7-year cycle at Atari because every 7 years he had a new crop of players. I think the cycle's much shorter today. And remember, the biggest competition that we have for gameplay, maybe the biggest competition that we have for entertainment is right here, because every kid coming into a bar is bringing his own touchscreen game with him. So, you know, we have to give them, as Harry said, the ball is wild, and we have to give them something to entertain them. Harry says to me, there's a game called Hot Hand. I've told this story a million times. It had a flipper about this big in the back that went around in a circle and knocked a ball out of rounded holes, each representing a different card. The kids are going to love this game. And I said, Harry, now remember, this is the 80s. I said, Harry, that's nice that the kids are going to love it, but your job's to get people drunk and keep them drunk, because our games were in bars in those days, and that's what we did. And that's what I'm seeing happen again, out-of-home entertainment, not in an arcade, but out-of-home entertainment.
You've managed to bring on board a lot of legendary designers and at least great games. What do you see as the future in terms of developing and cultivating new talent?
We are committed to doing that. We have some young designer software guys now. We're looking for, as we can as we can digest. You know, you can't just bring somebody in. You have to mentor and deal with and manage and so forth. We are committed to doing that because that's the future of pinball. And again, what do I care about the future of pinball? I mean, I'm 67, I can retire, I collect Social Security. It's what my family did. We're pinball manufacturers. And when I say, it's wonderful that people out here have a, I'm going to call it a cottage industry, you know, one-up games, the Predators and the Woe Nellies and the things like that. And the Woe Nellies, very cool. Predator, it looks like it will be. It's wonderful people do that, but we are manufacturers. And we have to cultivate talent to create product, to manufacture, to employ people, to export, to run the economy. American manufacturing. And pinball has been, with rare exception, American manufacturing.
Are there any times you trigger memories of your dad, or do you ever hear your dad's voice sometimes?
Yeah, that's, I know why you're asking the question. Sure there are. I say, again, he died in 84, so it's some time ago. But, you know, he used to wake me up every morning with a, you know, he figured I couldn't get up. Again, I was a 20-some-year-old kid, so he'd wake me up every morning. He'd get up at 6. When you get older, you wake up early. He'd get up at 6. At 7, he'd call to wake me up. We had to have an idea. Can't just call to wake me up. Some of them were real harebrained, but it was very cool sometimes to wake up every day to a new idea. Of course, I always answered the phone like I'd been up for hours because I didn't want him to think he was waking me up. We had this little game back and forth. And if one of my friends was out drinking and called me at 3 in the morning, oh, I'm glad I didn't wake you up. Well, you did wake me up. I thought it was Dad, you know, that type of thing. So, yeah. Oh, wonderful ones. Next question. Harry would be absolutely wowed with the technology that we have. They both would look at our games. I wish I brought that article. I meant to. And say that you're getting there again. AC/DC, and I'm going to talk about casual player. You know, not the premium, not the pro, but casual player. It's a spell out. Spell AC/DC, spell. There's something I understand what to do. I represent. We have to play games for 15 minutes a day as part of the design process. Everybody in the overhead group. And we got great players like Lyman. We got, you know, Shirley and Shelley in accounting and sales are good players. I think they're winning more money at night in the bars than they are getting paid by us. Somebody, I'm old and slow. Somebody has to represent the guy who's had 4 or 5 beer and plays. I represent him. So sober. Now you should see me play one. Actually, so I'm not going to do this one. I can't help myself. So I'm in Miss Street. Remember when we did our first game, Laser War? Steve Ritchie was, that's the one I was talking about earlier. His game, F-14, was out. And, I mean, he had just come off high speed. They sold 7,000, boom, right at the show. And it was just too tough a game for a lot of people. And I couldn't get the hang of playing it. So I'm in Miss Street, which is a Dutch city. And I'm going to see a new Dutch customer. And he puts me in the fancy hotel instead of the one across from the train station. And so I come down. And the bar, beautiful green carpet, which matched perfectly the football game, which is soccer, on TV. The bartender, one Dutch guy down there. To me, it was boring, so I went for a walk, and I find a pub. And on the pub, there's one of those long white pipes like this sitting there. That's for smoking hashish, guys, in case you don't know. And there's a cloud. I'm a vodka drinker. There's a cloud in the room, so I didn't need to smoke any hashish. And then there's a fruit machine next to an F-14. So I'm going to go play the pinball. And the couple playing the fruit machine offered me their cigar size joint. I said, no thanks. I got plenty. But I got my vodka. And the game was a little old and dirty, but I swear I finally got the hang of it, and I played it great. I'm sure of it. I'm just sure I did. Yeah. I'm sure there was a question I was answering, but God knows what it was anymore. Yes, sir.
Can you talk about your more outdoor domain?
The pin, which is a, we call it, it's an entry level game, and we are selling it through Amazon in America, and through Starburst and Cineplex in Canada. We intend to expand this. We have, you know, work to do and so forth as we do more models. It is non-coin op, but it plays great. George led the design to it, and he can tell you that the play field is the play area is virtually the same as a pinball, maybe 2 inches shorter. It plays like a pinball. It's real pinball parts. It's not a toy. It's not Zizzle's game like my friend Roger made, and he's a friend of ours. It's not coin up, but it plays like a real pinball machine. It is a real pinball machine is the way it does. What we're trying to do, remember I talked about operators, I talked about enthusiast collectors, and I talked about rich doctor lawyers. Well, rich doctor lawyers, we'd like them not to have to be so rich. People think pinball is cool if we can get them into it and get them to see it. We don't have enough on the street. We've got, you know, we've got the one-ups being opened. We need to get more pinball. There's no question you put something on an Amazon, there's pictures, you know, everywhere, on their, all their sites and all that. We're trying to expand pinball. We're trying to create an interest. We're trying to get young people to be interested in it. We want pinball to continue. So we have something to continue to manufacture. It's a pinball machine, though. It is not a toy. It is a pinball machine.
CBS's YouTube website featured a clip from Price to Gray, one of their games. The game they were playing had a certain pinball product. I can't remember which one it was. But I was wondering what kind of product placement. I mean,
I have to tell you, for years and years, Price is Right has had pinball machines. I mean, I'm going to go back 20 years. They used to get them from C.A. Robinson and so forth. I don't know. I know they're there. They don't ask us. It just happens. I honestly don't know what it's about. I don't know. But I keep my mouth shut. I don't know. I don't want them to ask me for something. I really don't know how that happens. I used to think it was Ira, but he retired. I don't know. I haven't talked to Ira in 2 days. I didn't ask him. Yes, sir. Well, you know, everything is outside our own designers in a sense. And that is that, first of all, you know that over the years, Steve Ritchie works for us and George works for us, but they've designed games for us when they didn't work for us. Pat Lawler has. We have right now a number of sound designers, and they're designers outside. We have electronics outside. We have a lot of work being done outside. Playfield design itself is not currently done outside, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't be. So the answer to your question is absolutely. We do, though, want, and to answer the question from over here, we want to groom and grow and mentor some inside employee designers that want this to be what their life should be. So that's important. I've talked to him. I don't have anything to do with it. Talk to him. No, seriously, it's him. We're careful about, let me point this out. We're careful, there's one thing about when we contract somebody to do something. We're very careful to accept or to look at things and have somebody. We've had a few problems. We had that we haven't contracted for. We had in the case of Pirates of the Caribbean. Let me point out that Pirates was a natural title to do. And I said to you guys, you know, pirate ship theme is easy. You know, I mean, you hit the ship, it sinks. I don't need you to figure this out. I got it. They one up me. They had the sails go down first, and then the ship sank. We had a design from '99 that. Works at IT. Hurtado did a playfield design. We didn't use it. But when we came out with that game, some younger lawyer decided it was his design, and we ripped him off. And so it cost us a lot of money for our lawyers to tell him he was a lousy lawyer to even think such a thing, which is the case. So we're very careful about what we look at. Other questions? Are you guys getting hungry or want a drink or something? Yes.
Can you share a little bit about how the relationship with Marvel
We license titles, and nowadays most of these companies have licensing groups. It's a big part of the business. You know, licensing started really as a big thing with Star Wars, and George Lucas goes in to see Ladd, who was the head of the studio, and says, "You owe me, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'll tell you what. Keep the money, just give me all the ancillary rights." And Ladd calls down his department, licensing group, you know, "How much do we do?" "Well, not that much." And says, "So, okay, fine, you have the ancillary rights." That was somewhat north of $1 billion ago, okay? If you make a mouse, the stuffed animal looks like a mouse, you're not going to sell it unless you pay Walt. They all have departments now that do this. What's important is that if they can get us involved with other creative people. The Simpsons artwork was done by Matt's people. Arnold does the speech on all the Terminator games. McFarlane, you know, did an hour of speech, some of which was his, some was ours, in Family Guy, that type of thing. It's important to be involved with other people. Get out of our ivory tower, other design people. And if you're looking for a title that is across the board, you know, these people, you know, there's a reason their stuff's successful. You know, they're building on top of something, and they have some knowledge of what their fan base is and what will be attractive and so forth. That it? Oh, one more.
Have you considered expanding the definition of what pinball is and breaking it into parlors with just single elements and having a smaller, different category?
I don't know how to answer that. I'm a little too pinball. George, does that ring anything to you? No? We need... We've done redemption games, and we have a redemption add-on that we will start selling soon, because redemption's a big part of the coin-op business. And that's where we're either ticketless or a box that goes on the side but does not destroy the game. You mount this box, George's design, with 4 carriage bolts, and the wires go underneath. And then if you want to take it off and put it in another game, you put 4 carriage bolts in the 4 holes, or you get a new decal for the side nowadays, that type of thing. In the coin-op business, redemption is very important in many parts of the world. It will help us introduce pinball. As far as, you know, chopping it down into lesser elements, Felix Hernan was Balicente in Spain. And he, and we're talking about, it's a gambling market with pinball as filler. Of course, right now with the 50% of the 25 and unders unemployed, it's a little bit tough of whatever kind of market it is. He said, you know, a pinball is a pinball is a pinball, meaning it's not a gambling machine. He had a big AWP amusement with prizes fruit machine business. So I don't know. We haven't done it. I don't know. Anything? We've done a lot of novelty redemption and would like to do that again one day, but our core focus is pinball. So one day might be a number of years from now. Our slapshot hockey we turned around and made into Simpsons, that type of thing. And we've done that, you know, and that had pinball parts in it. I mean, you think about it, it was a flipper underneath. Yes, yes, John.
We are on the expo floor in a couple of new games as well as also smaller companies really big ones designing. They do groups that is that interesting yet locally?
It is exceptionally interesting. The guys who are, you know, again, we're manufacturers. Okay? We design games to manufacture, and we design the games because we love pinball. We think the world would lose a little bit of the fabric of life if there wasn't pinball, mass pinball. And so we have to design for ourselves. The cottage industry of pinball, the Whoa Nellies and the Predators, they say, and some of the other things that you see out there are exceptionally interesting. And real interesting what people can do. We have a factory, and we need to make games, you know, in quantity that appeal to a broad market, and you know, a reliable appeal to a broad market, so forth, cost effective, that type of thing. We think there's things to learn. There may be some people to work with there, but it is exceptionally interesting. Yes, ma'am. Or is that ma'am's? It's ma'am's. Go ahead. Okay. Most of our export business is Western Europe. We sell some games to Russia. We sell some games to the Middle East. We sell some games to South America. We sell a lot of games to Australia. We sell, a few games into Asia, not a lot. We'd like to do a little bit more. We're working on a China project if we can get it done before the economy goes the wrong way. The games, again, we talk about three legs to our stool, operators, enthusiast collectors, and middle class homeowners. In our export market, each one's a little, different parts are different. In Russia, it is mostly operators. In Italy, it is 99% operators for new games, although the IFPA champion this year and 3 years ago, you know, two of the last 3 years, was Danielle from Italy, and he just won a tournament that I was at on Friday. What day is it today? Friday, I was in Rome. In Northern Europe, where it's a very predominantly gambling, soft gambling in the pubs or hard gambling in the arcades, there's less operators and more home collector enthusiasts. What we don't have in Europe is the rich doctor lawyers buying games for the home, that leg. In Australia, we have some rich doctor lawyers. We have a lot of enthusiasts. I'd say the business is 60-70% not operators. So it varies place to place. Australia has done a very big job of picking up on. They were early on. I was in Australia when they were introducing me to pinball enthusiasts 4 or 5 years ago as a big part of the market that they were going to concentrate on, and have hired people specifically for, you know, the non-coin-op side of the business. Does that answer your question? Any other questions, folks? One more. I wish I'd been there. I'd love that tour. I wish I was there. I'd like to chat with everybody in the parking lot and so forth.
So, at some point in the back, boxes of back games, complete games.
Yeah.
With sheets of paper.
Yes.
Like five in a row, one in that row. So we're looking at what we see, and the third game is the next time.
Yeah.
Tell me about
it. It's a game made in Spain. We bought one to look at. It's had some interesting technology in it. It's not much of but it's very interesting. But the guy who did it and George and I met him together. We had wanted the game, and one of his associates said, get this game. I said, there is no game. Finally, he built some games, and we were able to buy one, but it took for a long time. It took us over 2 years to get one, and he would make 20 of them. It's another, again, we talk about, this is a guy who loved pinball. He was making other product. We met him at the Egg Show, EAG, I call it the Egg Show. So we met him there and saw the game. We bought it, not from him, but through somebody else. And we buy other games, other people's games, to look at them. Again, here's a guy who was, you know, who has a factory, an operating factory, makes other coin machine product, but couldn't get pinball going as a real thing. But he did some interesting stuff there, and so that's why it's there. We may want to look at it again. You'll also find a vacation in a box back there, which was the Churchill game, and there's other stuff back there. God, there's some stuff back there that we find probably a couple bodies in boxes. I mean, who knows what's back there? Yeah. We'll probably find it because, you know, we're out of space, so we're building some more offices, as you know when you were there. I guess you know. Today they were building on them when I was there because I came off the plane and went to work. Yeah, they're building. That's offices. That's offices, yeah. George needs more space, so he's kicking us out. Okay, folks? Yes, yeah, Mike.
If I could quickly address a question about who's playing ball these days. On Thursdays, it's about six machines on free play, and people come in and go to mini tournaments, all age groups, and you're seeing a transition from where we used to just go out to a bar because they have a specific machine. Now we're seeing places that have multiple machines, to your point, Gary, so you have an easier machine and a harder machine in some spot, as opposed to one of the places that just have one machine, or maybe the beginner can't get into it.
And what he's doing is very important, because if we don't have people going out to play, if we're just playing in the basements, we're going to lose it. This is a social out-of-home entertainment. Nice to play it at home, but it is a social out-of-home entertainment. It's like the movie business. There's something different about watching a movie in a theater and watching it on your 52 or 32-inch screen at home. It takes a lot of money. It does take more money, and it takes more money to drink beer in a bar than it does at home. Beer, vodka. Anything else, folks? Thank you all very much. I appreciate you putting up with me just wandering around.